Welcome to Martian Drive-In Podcast 125. My name is Terry Frost, and this time around I'm looking at some weird films. The first one is the 1974 erotic science fiction adventure comedy film Flesh Gordon, starring Jason Williams and Suzanne Fields. And also I am going to be looking at a much darker and really creepier movie, this one being the 1981 David Cronenberg movie Scanners, starring Patrick McGoohan, Jennifer O'Neill, Stephen Lack, and, of course, last but not least, Michael Ironside. So sit back and get ready for the podcast. The Martian Drive-In Podcast is a fortnightly look at science fiction, fantasy and horror films. New or old, it does not matter. What matters is that we like them and we find them interesting. Feedback is our soil and green, so you can email it to cultguru@gmail.com. You can go over to the Paleo Cinema Cafe on Facebook and drop a note. You can leave a message at marsdrivein.blogspot.com or put your dulcet tones into a voicemail at the new number, write it down, 206-337-5398. Occasionally there'll be adult concepts discussed, so this podcast can be explicit. And I would like to send a shout out to the NSA, GCHQ, and the Australian Signals Directorate. I hope you enjoy the shows, you mongrels. Okay, so here we are with yet another Martian Driving podcast. First one for 2014. And ain't we futuristic for living in 2014? I wanted to see Jetsons-type cars that fold into suitcases. I want to see supercomputers taking over the world. I want to see alien invasions. I want to see a post-apocalyptic landscape but with Wi-Fi. And I want to see all those other good things that we've been waiting for and have been disappointed have not occurred. I basically blame capitalism for that, so go figure, what can you do about it? But anyway, I hope everybody had a great time off over the festive season. I hope you didn't eat too much and go into a tryptophan coma with the turkey. I hope that the relatives didn't start a knife fight in the kitchen. I hope nobody set it on fire. I hope that the Christmas tree didn't go up like in National Lampoon's Christmas Vacation. And I hope, basically, that all is sanguine and cool with you people at the moment. We're doing okay here. It's summertime and the living is easy. Mangoes are in season. All the stone fruits are in season. And so we're eating relatively healthily. I'm riding my bicycle around. No good movies really coming out lately, which is a little bit odd. Usually we get a couple of nice ones over the break, but 2014, as I mentioned last Martian Driving podcast, is going to be a bumper year for superhero movies and other groovy things. Lots of genre works in the offing, so we've got that to look forward to. And if my voice sounds different now, it's because I've changed microphones. The other one, which is a new one I bought with a little bit of holiday money, isn't as nice to my ears as this one is. So if it sounds a little bit more tinny, I apologize, but the other one was driving my ears nuts. So we have two movies for you this time around. The first one being the 1974 parody science fiction comedy thing, Flesh Gordon, that's Flesh with an E, starring Jason Williams and Suzanne Fields. And the other one I thought I'd go a little more serious and constructive with, and that is the 1982 David Cronenberg movie Scanners. Sorry, 1981, I misspoke. So we're going to do Scanners and Flesh Gordon. I think I'll do Scanners first so I can just sit back and enjoy myself with Flesh Gordon secondly. So what genre stuff have I been watching since the last time I did this? I did pick up a very cheap, like $8, Blu-ray of Westworld, the Michael Crichton-based movie back from the 70s with Yul Brynner playing the robot, Richard Benjamin, James Brolin, and people like that. And it was nice to revisit that. I think the sexual politics of having basically sex bots is a little bit iffy, and one of the things about this, and this is a purely personal thing, I'm going to get a little personal here. I don't think they could ever get robots to feel or smell right if they're emulating human beings. Whether it's a male or a female, there are so many complex pheromones and hormones and chemicals that we sense both through our sense of smell and our sense of taste in any act of dalliance that, no, it just wouldn't happen. Rubber dolls have only got a very limited market out there, and there's a reason why. And no, thank you. And I can't get past that part. Apart from that, yeah, I mean, it works well as an action flick and as a technology gone wrong kind of flick, and it's very well made, and it's very 1970s in a lot of ways. But the characters aren't particularly well drawn, but I think that for this kind of film, maybe they don't particularly need to be. But nonetheless, I would have liked to have just a little bit more characterization, particularly for the Richard Benjamin character. It's a little bit $6 Million Man. In fact, there are a couple of actors who went on to do the $6 Million Man in this movie, particularly Alan Oppenheimer playing one of the scientists. And yeah, I mean, of course, it spun a sequel and a TV series and all that kind of things. But I think, even though I do love the groovy 1970s computers, I think it's dated a little bit. And it's one of those movies that's ripe for some idiot to remake. I hope they don't. I think it's a standalone artifact of its time and not to be dismissed for that. But I really don't think we need a remake if anybody's even considering it. So I saw that, and for $8 it was worth it, really. And one of the other things I did was I picked up a copy of The Power. I've talked about this in previous podcasts. The Byron Haskin directed George Powell movie The Power, starring Michael Rennie, George Hamilton, and Suzanne Plachet, about a superhuman being that's found in a lab and all that kind of thing. And yeah, it was good revisiting that. It's the sharpest one I've seen. Of course, I've previously had VHS copies and downloads, and really sharp sound and picture quality, and I'm glad I got that as part of my Newton Mass present this year, or last year for you, but I'm recording this just before the new year. And I enjoyed that actually a lot more than I enjoyed Westworld, for that matter. But yeah, it's a lot of fun, and it's one of those things that's kind of on the brink of being really, really good, but maybe because it's a studio film from the middle 1960s and it was delayed a year or so in being released, it kind of didn't quite get there. But it was worth revisiting, and I had a lot of fun watching that. I know I mentioned this in Paleo Cinema podcast, but I did also see the Criterion Blu-ray of I Married a Witch. I Married a Witch, starring Frederick March and Veronica Lake from 1942. And it's a lot of fun. It's got Robert Benchley in it. It's a nice, saucy little comedy. And Veronica Lake was never more attractive and likable than in this film. She's cute. She's forthright. And she does go around wearing some negligees that are quite intriguing in their briefness, in a sense, which is a bit surprising for 1942, but it is a lot of fun. As I said in the last Paleo Cinema, it did influence things like Bewitched and other TV series that came later on. And it is an amusing little souffle of a film, which I'm going to have to look at all the extras for now, because there's no use buying the Criterion Blu-ray unless you dip into the extras. Not sure when I'm going to get about to it, but I will. Having said that, I'm going to take a break, and when I get back, I'm going to talk about Scanners, as Patrick McGoohan says.
I would like to scan all of you in this room, one at a time. I must remind you that the scanning experience is usually a painful one, sometimes resulting in nosebleeds, earaches, stomach cramps, nausea, sometimes other symptoms of a similar nature. At this point, I'd like to call for volunteers. Fine. Just sit right here, please. Now, I'd like you to think of something specific.
Do I have to close my eyes?
It doesn't matter.
All right, yes, I have something.
Yes.
Okay, Scanners is a 1981 Canadian film directed by David Cronenberg, whose oeuvre we all know fairly well. Basically, it's a story. Let me have a look. I'll find a plot for us. And I should have done that before I started speaking. Won't be a moment. Right, I have one here from IMDb. Daryl Revick is the most powerful of all the Scanners and is the head of an underground scanner movement for world domination. Scanners have great psychic power, strong enough to control minds. They can inflict enormous pain and damage on their victims. Dr. Paul Ruth finds a scanner that Revick hasn't and converts him to the cause to destroy the underground movement. That's pretty much it. Now, we all know, as I said, we all know Cronenberg's work. His first any number of films. Let me just go down the list. And I'm going to... I know the list are a bit boring, but I'm going to go through this for a particular reason. First movie was Stereo in 1969, Crimes of the Future 1970, Shivers and Rabid, Fast Company, which is a car racing movie, very atypical, in 1979. Then The Brood, which is another fine movie in science fiction. Scanners, Videodrome, The Dead Zone, The Fly, Dead Ringers, Naked Lunch, M. Butterfly, Crash. His last overtly science fiction movie was Existence in 1999. Then in 2002, he did a very good movie called Spider, starring Ralph Fiennes, which I recommend highly. A History of Violence, Eastern Promises, A Dangerous Method, Cosmopolis, which is widely considered to be a failure. And in 2014, he's got a movie about a Hollywood producing dynasty or something like that called Maps of the Stars. So he's kind of drifted away from science fiction over the last decade and a half. But his earlier stuff is the best of the best. He was a science fiction fan from a very early age. He studied science, in fact, at university before he changed his majors to literature and art. But he did have a good background in the botanical and, oddly enough, Lepidopteras, so insect science. And then, he was interested in movies as well, made a few art house films and a few small things, and then started his career as a movie writer. He said that his main influences are William S. Burroughs and Vladimir Nabokov, which is why he did Naked Lunch as one of the movies being a Burroughs book. But for a while there, he was tagged with the tag of being the master of venereal horror. Now, Scanners isn't particularly venereal, but he did have this kind of way of bringing science fiction into the visceral and the physical and the biological in a way that nobody has before or since. He really has kind of looked at science fiction from the viewpoint of how it physically and emotionally affects human beings in a lot of his work, all the way from Stereo to Existence. It shows all of that, The Fly being probably the big example of that internalization of a scientific change to the detriment of the person who internalizes it.
But I think I can understand why Cronenberg has jumped off the bandwagon of science fiction. I think the kind of science fiction that Hollywood makes now is overwhelmingly, and this is studio science fiction, not your independent things, but overwhelmingly about spectacle and about special effects and about blowing the socks off people visually. And that's not necessarily what Cronenberg wanted to do. His science fiction is a lot more intimate. It's a couple of people in a room trying to take over each other's minds in scanners. It's one guy in a teleportation experiment being genetically mixed up with a fly. It's a woman who gets a skin graft after a burn and suddenly develops a kind of wasp sting under her armpit. It's all that kind of stuff. It's existence where computer games become a biological artifact. And that's followed through, interestingly, in that film. So he's not about giant explosions, asteroids, and pranging things into the Earth full of aliens. He's very much... That was never his interest, and it was never going to be his interest. Now, he even admitted that the name Scanners, for getting back to the movie I'm talking about, he borrowed the name from a Scanner Darkly, Philip K. Dick, so he's very science fictionally literate. In fact, he tried to write some science fiction in his early years as well. So he'd read very widely in the genre. He knew the good from the shit. He knew the tropes and expectations of the genre. And I think that all of his science fiction movies are consistent with that. They really do have that discipline that good science fiction has, where you've got to stay true to your premise. You don't send people out of the cinema going, hey, how come that didn't happen? That should have happened because of this. You don't get any of that with Cronenberg. It's internally consistent, and there's a tight discipline to the science fiction of David Cronenberg that is really interesting. Now, to get on to Scanners, the cast is very good too. I do like the cast. I think that there were people complaining about Stephen Lack playing Cameron Vale, the kind of undetected scanner. He plays it a bit dull, but the character demands that. There are needs in the character that demand that. You've got Patrick McGoohan as Dr. Paul Ruth, and we all know McGoohan from Danger Man and The Prisoner. He's got his own place in the iconography of fandom, in a way. Lawrence Dane playing Braden Keller, one of the bad guys. Michael Ironside playing Daryl Revick, the rogue scanner who wants to create an army of scanners and take over the world and all that. An interesting character actor called Robert A. Silverman playing an artist called Benjamin Pierce, who's a scanner, but uses his art to manage his abilities, because without something to control the abilities, scanners can become very destructive and self-destructive, and they can't keep everybody else's thoughts out of their heads. So Pierce is there as a way of saying there are other ways, and there are peaceful ways of managing these abilities. The bottom line is that a drug was given to pregnant women called ephemerol, which was to handle nervousness, and ephemerol ended up giving scanner abilities to the children of those pregnant women. It's a little bit like thalidomide. Women were given thalidomide as an antidepressant in the 1950s and early 1960s, not realizing that if they took it during the first 3 months of pregnancy, there were developmental problems, and of course thalidomide babies, as they were called, with deformed arms and legs and other issues like that. There were a lot of thalidomide people around about 30, 40 years ago, kids in particular. And I remember at one stage in the 1980s, there was a cab driver in Adelaide who had one arm small and with only two or three fingers on it, who was driving around Adelaide as a cab driver and doing and making a good living as a cabbie. So people, you know, that kind of relates back to that in a sense. Now, Patrick McGoohan, a really interesting actor, and not just for the stuff he's done. I was reading a book called Cronenberg on Cronenberg, which is a Faber book edited by Chris Rodley. And there are a few things that Cronenberg said about Scanners. First off, he said it was the most difficult movie he ever made up until that time. And he said it more recently too, Maybe there have been other ones since then that were difficult for him, but this one was incredibly difficult. They were still writing the script while they were filming. The production manager was still trying to find locations. The studios wanted the film made within a certain window, and to do that, they really had to start before they were ready to start. So locations and sets and things like that just weren't built by the time they were starting to film. So it was crazily busy for Cronenberg. And then he had to deal with Patrick McGoohan. Now, McGoohan, in a sense, his life was nightmarish because he had enormous stage fright, which he self-medicated with alcohol. Now, I was thinking through that, and I was thinking what that would be like. Imagine you've done something for 30 or 40 years. It's the job you really wanted to do all your life. It's a job that's been very emotionally and financially rewarding for you. And suddenly you get to a stage where it terrifies you. How do you manage that? How do you manage the one thing you know how to do, the one thing you do well, the one thing you're known and acclaimed for, scares the fuck out of you? That must be a horrible place to be. And that, unfortunately, was where Patrick McGoohan was at the stage of making Scanners. He and Cronenberg didn't get on, which was problematic given the fact that he was directing the film. And in spite of that, I think it's a very fine role by Patrick McGoohan. And I've just dropped something, but I'll ignore that. I think that his Dr. Ruth is very much different from the characters he's playing in Danger Man and things like that. He kind of gives us a new twist on the mad scientist. Rational, calm, not unsympathetic, intelligent, but totally, and the name says it all, Dr. Paul Ruth, totally ruthless in order to get what he wants. As far as the scientific people in this concerned, and there are no good guys in this, there's a company called Consec, which is making ephemeral again in order to create new scanners. And there's a lovely scene in a doctor's waiting room where one of the characters is scanned by a newborn, by a baby in utero, which is kind of an interesting way of doing things, and very much Cronenberg. He really does think through his premise and does run with some of the more unpleasant kind of implications of it, which I really like. Jennifer O'Neill, very beautiful actor, but I'm not sure she was gifted. People knew her first in the summer of 42, where she played a young wife of a soldier who had gone overseas to fight in World War II, who has an affair with a teenage boy. It was one of those kind of romantic, soft-focus, lovey-dovey kind of films, which teenage boys liked because it gave them the hope of making love to somebody like Jennifer O'Neill. And she'd done a number of other movies. She was in The Carey Treatment with James Coburn in 72, and a few other things. But really, her career wasn't enormously successful. But yeah, she does okay as very much a secondary character in here, because the two characters are mostly Stephen Lack's character, Cameron Vale, who's a scanner that's lived all his life with everyone's voice in his head, so he hasn't had time to listen to his own voice and develop a personality. And there are some really nice scenes where Dr. Ruth gives him an injection of ephemeral, and all of the other voices in his head diminish so he can, for the first time, hear his own voice in his head, which, again, is cool science fiction. It's really neat the way that Cronenberg has thought through the implications of telepathy and the implications of being able to hear other people's thoughts. And it borrows a lot of that stuff from people like Alfred Bester, of course, but he translates that into the visual medium of film very, very well. In fact, he gets Dr. Ruth to Cameron strapped to a bed, and Dr. Ruth brings a whole bunch of people in to sit around him so that he does have those voices in his head, to the point where he's almost in convulsions. Then he gives him the injection and the voices fade. So there's a visual demonstration of that 1,000 voices in your head kind of telepathy, which is really cool. Now, the other thing scanners can do, of course, is control the autonomic functions of other people. And that's where things get interesting. There's some great special effects in this film, particularly makeup effects, mostly by Chris Wallace and a team of other people. But one of the cool things structurally that Cronenberg does with this film is it gives you two great scanner action sequences right at the start of the film, which satisfies the bloodlust of the audience so that he can go into the exposition that he needs to do to tell the story after these two scenes. The first one is Cameron Bale in a small shopping centre, scrounging food off trays that people have left behind, and wandering around in a grubby overcoat and beanie. And he overhears a couple of middle-aged women talking about how disgusting he is. And he causes one of them to go into convulsions and have a stroke or something like that. She convulses on the floor. Now, he's then captured by two people working for Dr. Ruth, who tranquilize him as he runs through the shopping center and take him to see Dr. Ruth. The second one is a demonstration of scanner abilities for various intelligence agencies. This is the famous scene in Scanners where Michael Ironside and Louis Delgrand are sitting at a table, and Louis Delgrand, as a scanner, is going to scan Michael Ironside, not knowing that he's Daryl Revick, and it ends with that famous exploding head scene, which is one of the best exploding head scenes in cinema history, really, and very cool. The way they did it, which is kind of interesting to show the magic of cinema, is they had a head made, a rubber head made, or a vinyl or plastic or whatever head made of Louis Delgrand, filled it full of dog meat and offal, and hit it and shot it from behind with a shotgun to get that effect. Which is, they had three heads made up like that, and they did it three times, but Cronenberg liked the first shot, so they kept the first shot, which shows how interesting it is the way that they do things sometimes pre-CGI. I mean, it would have been given over to a CGI company if it had been done now. But this, as a purely physical effect, does work well. And at the time, I remember seeing it in the cinema when it first came out. This is the first Cronenberg movie that got a wide cinema release in Australia. I know that one of his earlier films also got a release, but not as widely. Rabid got a release because it had Marilyn Chambers in it in Australia, but it mostly played drive-ins and smaller cinemas. But Scanners is really the one that got a wide release in Australia in the suburban cinemas. And I saw it, and yeah, that is a shocking scene with the head explosion. It's unexpected, over-the-top, silly, and very, very effective, of course.
I don't suppose you speak much.
No.
It's not surprising. With all those other voices in your head, how can you hear your own voice? How can you develop a self, a personality? How do you feel?
I feel crystal clear.
How do you like it? Clarity.
I'm not sure. I think I'm a bit afraid.
Why?
I feel so exposed. I can hear myself.
You hear your own voice?
Yes.
Good.
You called me a scanner. What is that?
Freak of nature, born with a certain form of ESP. The derangement of the synapses, which we call telepathy. It could be a disease, possibly, or a result of radiation. We don't really know why.
Who are you?
My name is Dr. Paul Ruth. I'm a psychopharmacist by trade, specializing in the phenomenon of scanners.
So, why should you see this film if you haven't, and why should you revisit it if you have? It's a very effective movie. It hasn't dated much at all. The technology, of course, is dated, but I think that the way the story plays out, it hasn't aged. There are any number of other movies from around the time, early 1980s, which have suffered because of time, but this one definitely hasn't. I think Cronenberg's intelligence and discipline and his approach to the material is very, very effective, and I think it works. The story takes you along. It's well structured, in spite of the fact that they were writing the script on the hop, parts of the script at least, on the hop while they were making the film. I think it holds together very, very well, and it was very successful at the time. So the reasons you should see it are, it's a classic of the genre, very good acting, a top director, just as he kind of reaches that top part. It was his big financial success at the start. And also, it's a movie that spawned a number of sequels. In fact, they're trying to do a remake, though I hope they won't. The sequels to the movie were ridiculously bad. They kind of were like bad photocopies of the first one. 1991, you had Scanners 2, The New Order. 1992, Scanners 3, The Takeover. Then Scanner Cop in 1994 and Scanners The Showdown in 1995. They were talking about a TV series in 2011 as well, but the reason you should see this is it's the original. It's a bit like the remade RoboCop. See the original and see where it came from. With Scanners, it's the same thing. See the original. It's a very, very effective film, and it is something that gives us all of our genre jollies without us feeling guilty about it, which is always a nice thing. Anyway, I'm going to take a break now. I'm going to get back. I'm going to talk about the second film for this podcast. Very, very different piece of cinema called Flesh Gordon.
Gentlemen, we are in big trouble.
You've heard about it. You've read about it. Now, finally, you can see it.
It will be a dangerous trip, and I don't know what we're likely to encounter out there. But someone has got to save the Earth from the treacherous clutches of that evil ray.
Sure. Why not? We'll give it a try.
Blast off with Flesh Gordon in his cosmic crusade against all evil. Witness the unbelievable, death-defying feats of that most remarkable superhero of them all, Flesh Gordon. Journey with Flesh Gordon through the dangerous outer reaches of intergalactic space as he joins forces with the mysterious Professor and the lovely Dale Arder to save the Earth from the incredible sex ray. Flesh Gordon, the ridiculous,
my ass,
the unmentionable, the preposterous, be swept away to the dazzling heights of astonishment as you enter worlds unknown.
Good, there's oxygen on this planet.
Your sickness, we have captured the Earth people and await your command.
The Earth people, eh? Bring them to me at once.
Enjoy with Flesh the bizarre pleasures of the forbidden planet.
I am Chief Nelly.
I'm Prince Precious, rightful heir to the throne of porno. Ah!
What is it? A floor! It's opening!
Join Flesh Gordon as the crafty Emperor Wang unleashes the forces of interstellar tyranny against him in 100 mind-boggling adventures.
I just want to look at your tits.
Flesh Gordon.
Look!
An outrageous parody of yesteryear's superhero.
It's the eighth wonder of the world.
Oh, boy.
Not to be confused with the original Flash Gordon.
Okay, I might have said this before, but I was actually at the Australian premiere of Flesh Gordon way back in the 1970s. And having done my sums, I realised that I was underage to see the movie at the time. It was at the Academy Twin Cinema in Paddington in New South Wales, in a suburban Sydney. at a midnight session. So here was me. I must have been, let's see, it was 1974, 75. Must have been just under 18 at the time. And I went and saw it and got a free poster, which I now regret losing, because a full-sized one sheet of Flesh Gordon in good nick would be worth a fair bit of money these days. But I enjoyed it at the time. I think it was a slightly shorter version than the one I've now acquired a copy of. And I enjoyed it for slightly different reasons as a young teenager than I now do as a gentleman of mature years. This film also has a lot of associations with my cultural roots, by which I mean science fiction fandom. There are a number of fans and also writers who had input to this movie. The special effects, which for a $700,000 budget porno movie are superb, had people like John Dykstra and Greg Jean and Mike Minor and Rick Baker and other people along those lines doing either costumes, makeup effects, or effects for the film. So it's got a really good look. The stop motion animation in particular, the kind of insect monster that fights Flesh Gordon, the penosauruses, the great god porno are all top notch stuff. Now, before I get too far ahead, I'm going to, even though it's probably a bit useless to do this, I'm going to do a bit of a pricey on Flesh Gordon for you. We'll see what the magic we know as IMDb comes up with. Let's see. See full summary. Emperor Wang the Perverted is the leader of the planet Porno and sends his mighty sex ray towards the Earth, turning everyone into sex mad fiends. Only one man can save the Earth, football player Flesh Gordon, along with his new girlfriend Dale Ardent and Professor Flexie Jerkoff. They set off toward the source of the sex ray, unaware of the perils that face them on the planet Porno. That's as good as any, so that's basically it. It is a parody of Flash Gordon, and they had to put disclaimers on all their media saying not to be confused with Flash Gordon, so that they wouldn't get their backsides sued by the studios who own the rights to Flash Gordon. Now, to be honest with you, neither Buster Crabbe, who played the original Flash Gordon, nor Jason Williams, who plays Flash Gordon, were particularly good actors. They couldn't act their way out of a parking ticket. And neither is Suzanne Field, who plays Dale in the movie. But having said that, there are a couple of other interesting actors in the film. I'm actually going to mention the acting, surprisingly enough. One of whom is Joseph Huggins playing Flexie Jerkoff. He has a couple of good moments in there and puts things across very well. And Emperor Wang the Perverted was played by an actor called William Dennis Hunt, who has done a lot of theatre work in California since then. He's been in everything from Ibsen and Chekhov to Shakespeare. He really has had a long career, and he has continued as an actor as well. In fact, he was in the episodes of Modern Family, Cold Case, Everybody Hates Chris. He played a Klingon in an episode of Star Trek Deep Space Nine. In fact, so good long character actor's career. The makeup for Emperor Wang is pretty poor, which is why they don't do too many close-ups of him in this film. It looks a little bit like somebody's got some wallpaper, you know, wall plaster and just put it on there along with a bunch of drag queen makeup. It's really not a good look, and that aspect of it lets the movie down a little bit. But there are also some other fun bits in there. There's Lance Larson playing Prince Precious, the true leader of the planet Porno, who is very much gay. Candy Samples gets a look in as Chief Nelly, the underground Amazon army leader, who takes a shine, who people take a shine to Dale, as indeed one must in this kind of a movie at this kind of time. You've got to have the obligatory lesbian scenes, but I'll get this out of the way. I'll talk about the sex scenes and the nudity and things like that, and then we can deal with the actual movie itself. The sex scenes aren't particularly erotic. They border on hardcore in places, but they're not particularly erotic for some reason. Now, this was produced by a guy called Bill Osco, who also produced another kind of light, fluffy, almost inoffensive porn movie being Alice in Wonderland, which I talked about in an early Paleo Cinema podcast, the one with Christine DeBell in it. And, the Alice in Wonderland is a lot more erotic than Flesh Gordon. Maybe because they've got to keep the plot going and they've got to follow all the tropes of the Flash Gordon TV series. But having said that, there's nudity, male and female. There are a few other bits and pieces. But one of the bits I've seen this movie like 6 or 7 times. One thing I only really paid attention to this time around, and maybe because I've seen a slightly longer cut of it, is after Dale and Flash and Flexi Jerkoff are rescued by Prince Precious. Flash says, anything I can do for you. And Prince Precious says, I'll think of something. And then they cut to a scene, just a panning shot of, Flesh Gordon getting a blowjob from Prince Precious on aboard their little, spaceship, which is shaped like a ladybug. I hadn't noticed that before. Maybe the cuts I've seen of it didn't have that in there, or maybe my attention was elsewhere. But they do have just a moment of gay sex in the movie. And I think it's stronger for that. These kind of films need a little bit of polymorphous perversity about them. And too many porn films don't, while they acknowledge lesbianism in a way that's titillating the males, there's not even a nod toward homosexuality. And even though there are a few jokes where some of Prince Precious's guys start trying to feel up Flexi Jerkoff, for a movie of this era, the gay stuff isn't dealt with in a particularly bad way. Flesh does get it on with Prince Precious, for instance. So, on the other side, the lesbians who try to, I'm putting little air quotes here, recruit Dale, don't come off as well, but the male panic about, oh, dykes, is more against the male reaction to them than the fact that they're female homosexuals. But, yeah, putting 21st century sexual politics onto a film like this is always a little bit problematic. You can't really expect to do it because, in a sense, the past is a different culture. And while you can say there are things wrong with that culture and there are things that were impacting people badly, I don't think you can realistically expect them to have the same viewpoint on things as we have. But you can acknowledge when they get it right by our beliefs these days, as indeed they do with a small little bit of gay sex between Prince Precious and Flesh Gordon. But having said that, it is a fun movie. It's probably good to watch back-to-back the original Flash Gordon series, and it was a movie serial, and then compare it to Flesh Gordon. I think you'll find the parodies quite accurate and quite interesting as well. The monsters, even though they're not the same as the beast men from the original Flash Gordon, are there. Ming the Merciless is slightly different than Wang is in the movie. But there are some nice little nods and bits and pieces there too. The implied racism is there, particularly when Flesh starts beating on Wang and starts calling him a slanty-eyed so-and-so and things like that. It's an explicit acknowledgement that these movie serials and the underlying culture that produced them was racist. Ming the Merciless being a kind of extension into space of the Yellow Peril, whereas Wang's just a sad guy that got his dick bitten off by a penis flytrap. But having said that, I think that the movie is a lot of fun, and it does have that lightness of touch that you don't see in parody erotica anymore. You really don't get any of that. There's only one way to say it. There's a sweetness to it that's really we don't have anymore in modern ones. Maybe because people are less hung up and guilty, and maybe because there are some other issues that we now have to deal with, like AIDS and things like that, which have kind of changed the cultural climate in a way that has affected our viewing of these kind of films. But I really do like it. The set designs are kind of rudimentary at times, though. The spaceship that
Flexi Jerkoff designs while under the throes of the sex ray alone in his cabin is quite fun and kind of is a really interesting acknowledgement of the phallic nature of spaceships as they are and were in the movies. And the fact that they go past a planetoid where an enormous eye in a crater follows the path of the spaceship and a little sign on one of the planetoids that says for sale. And all those kind of nice little cartoony references which almost hark back to things like Duck Dodgers are kind of fun, and that goes through the movie as well when Flexi Jerkoff gives Dale a nightgown to wear. He says it was my mother, she was buried in it. And those kind of little throwaway lines are there in the film, which is kind of cool. Now, I'm not going to say that this film is the Citizen Kane of porno parodies, but it is very much of its time, and I think it was a time when things were seen a lot differently and a lot more playful than they are now. There's a movement towards kind of demonizing erotica, which I kind of don't like. I think erotica's perfectly fine. There's a really good essay from back in the early 70s by Kenneth Tynan called In Praise of Hardcore, which looks into the politics of demonizing erotica. And he makes an interesting point. Now, whether it's valid or not, it's entirely up to you. But he makes an interesting point that it's okay for a movie to scare the shit out of people and to terrify them, but it's not okay for them to get aroused by a film. Now, that's an interesting line to draw if you try to step outside your own culture a bit and look at it. Why can't a movie arouse people? Is there something wrong with being aroused? We are kinder towards violence, even sexual violence, than we are to erotica these days. And I'm not sure that's the right way to go. I think even stuff which is kind of down market and very much dismissed like 50 Shades of Grey at least acknowledges the fact that people do read erotica and do find pleasure in it, whether it's an intellectual pleasure or a much more pelvic kind. One way or the other, they do enjoy it, and more strengthens them for that. I think that censorship isn't a way to go, and being dismissive of the power of vision and words to elicit kind of a sexual response isn't the way a healthy society lives. But Flesh Gordon, really fun movie from my point of view. It's I kind of, even though it did have the porn, did have the nudity, and did have the sex ray and the silliness in it, these days I viewed it more as a parody of Flesh Gordon, a comedy parody of Flesh Gordon, than I did as a kind of explicitly erotic film, which is kind of an interesting change. Maybe it's a change in me. I mean, my hormones are still working, but maybe they're working slightly differently. But in spite of the shit acting and some of the crude sets, and those little caveats I have about the sexual politics of the film, I still think it's a little bit of fun. It's silly. It's an artifact of its time. It's a movie artifact as well. It is part of movie history, and we've got to acknowledge that. You can't just dismiss all of erotica just because these days it tends to be 5-minute clips on PornTube that have no plot and make no sense and have acting that's slightly worse than really atrocious. There were actually movies that men and women went to see together in the cinema that were sexually explicit. Now, I don't know whether people would do that these days. I mean, there are a certain number of films that are erotic, but they tend to be art house films and they tend to be very highbrow stuff, which again goes back to Kenneth Tynan's essays, where he says there's a certain class of person who thinks that brothels are okay, but only if they're manned by attractive social workers in Balenciaga gowns.
So if it's upmarket and erotic, it's okay. If it's downmarket and erotic, it's not okay. But that, I suppose, in some ways is how it's always been in our culture. But I do like Flesh Gordon. It's not a movie I'm going to see a lot, but it is a bit of fun. It's a nostalgic thing for me, and it is a worthwhile parody of a certain genre of science fiction films from the 1930s. Oh, by the way, the other thing I should mention is The Great God Porno, who's a kind of big, not quite King Kong, but a King Kong-esque character. The voice of The Great God Porno was played by the American actor Craig T. Nelson, even though it's never in the credits. It was Craig T. Nelson's voice playing The Great God Porno. So there's not too much else to say about Flesh Gordon. It is what it is. It's interesting. It's fun. And it's a giggle. And we need more giggles in our lives these days. By the way, there was a sequel to the film, Flesh Gordon Meets the Cosmic Cheerleaders. I think it was made in about the 1980s. And I don't particularly recommend it. It's dumb and doesn't have anywhere near the charm of the first one. But if you want to be a completist, you can find a copy of it around the place if you look. But that's about it for Flesh Gordon.
Taking another break now, and then the feedback.
Angel, come to
That, of course, was Supreme Beings of Leisure with Touch Me. Yes, I do like some music that's not from the 1950s. On with the feedback, and here is the first of the two voicemails I received.
Happy holidays, Terry. This is Tim from Central New York and the Internet. I am going to leave you a voice message because I keep promising myself I would, and the way the years turned out so far, I didn't have much chance to do it until, well, literally the morning of Christmas Day here in New York. So, got a bunch of things that I heard you talking about on the podcast, mostly paleo cinema. I mean, mostly Martian Drive-In, I'm sorry. And I want to address the last thing I heard you talk about in Martian Drive-In number 23 first, which was your comment about streaming movies as a service and not a product. This kind of ties into something I was talking about in an earlier message to you, the one about my thought that perhaps with the popularity of streaming, we would see DVDs and Blu-rays become more of a special features kind of thing. We would see less of people just, well, here's a movie, here's a trailer, end of story. And you'd get things more like commentaries, you'd get special features for every movie that was put out. For the collector audience and the mainstream audience would largely just consume streaming media. This is something you're starting to see a lot in the United States. Tammy, for instance, watches an awful lot of movies on streaming. She will occasionally buy a DVD if it's a movie she can't otherwise get. Like she just ordered the Inagaki Chishingura and the Big Brawl with Jackie Chan because she wants our niece to see them. And we are, so we had to order them specially, and they were actually quite expensive because they're largely out of print, and you can't get them through Netflix streaming. You can't get them through Hulu Plus. You can't even get them through Netflix disc. You've got to buy them. So the thing is yes, that is a concern of mine. I do worry that streaming movies will turn movies into more of a service. Actually, this goes back to something I heard about 15, 20 years ago, back when I was doing consumer electronics articles for a living. We had one of the associate editors of the magazine I worked for at the time, Video Magazine, arguing in favor of saying, you know, this is the reality. This is how it's going to be. Sooner or later, you won't be collecting movies. You'll just be getting them. You won't own them. You won't even own the physical media. They will come to you to temporarily watch, and then they will go away. So this whole ownership nonsense will be done. The movies will belong to the studios. All they belong to. Real asshat. Thankfully, he wasn't my editor, and thankfully, he didn't last very long at Video Magazine either. But he was very much a shill for the industry. And sorry about that. Honestly, I don't think most of the other writers or editors liked him that much. The thing is, I think the studios would like nothing more than for you to see movie as just a service, to see it as something that you stream once, you pay for, or one way or another, every time it streams. Ideally, they'd like you to pay for it physically every time you do it, but that's not going to be possible. People just won't do it. They've tried it that way. They tried it with, remember DivX? Did that ever make it to Australia? DivX was not the DivX codec, which everybody uses now. DivX as a form of DVD that you have to have connected to a phone line so it can call in, check if you have the rights to watch this movie, let you watch it for a 48-hour period, and then you can either pay to watch it for another month, you can pay to watch it permanently, or you cannot, and the disc becomes useless. It just becomes landfill, basically. This was something commented on by a number of people at the time. Tammy's listening to some music in the background right now. And we're in New York City visiting our friend Raquel for Christmas, and we're staying in a hotel because New York City, nobody has any room to free to stay in the house. This was, as somebody put it, an idea that only a lawyer could love. And, of course, Circuit City, at the time, major consumer electronics chain in the United States, and a bunch of lawyers came up with it and ran it past the studios. The studios were ecstatic. It was exactly what they wanted. The problem is they didn't offer any special features to the disc. While the discs were supposedly cheaper, you had to have a special player. You had to have it hooked up to your phone line back when secondary phone lines were not that common, or let alone internet connections were not that common. There's no such thing as, like, you know, having a broadband internet was so uncommon that I was the first person I knew at that point in time who actually had a DSL connection to my office, not even in our home. We had dial-up in the home. So this was a hassle for everyone to use, everyone who didn't have a computer hooked up and a second line for a computer. And who'd want to use your second computer line to dial up to get permission to watch a movie? Disney really liked it. They went heavily into DivX for about a year or two until it turned out nobody bought any of their movies. Then they just gave up and they went back to DVD. They went into DVD heavily because they realized DivX was no market for anybody. Anyway, streaming video is kind of what they wanted to do with DivX, only it's been a lot more successful. One, because there are less hassles to use streaming media than to use DivX. More people have broadband internet access. I mean, even in the United States, where our internet access is frankly pretty awful, more and more companies are beginning to offer like 25, 50, and 100 megabit per second streaming, or 100 megabit per second downloads, so that people can watch high definition streaming movies. And in fact, you know, I set that up for Tammy about 2 years ago, and I don't think she's ever looked back. She loves the fact that she can just sit down, order a movie from Netflix, and watch it. Anyway, that's some of my thoughts on it, and I'd like to hear what your response would be. Tammy's in the bathroom going, are you going to jaw Terry to death? So I hope you and Sally had a wonderful Newton Mass. You gave each other gifts of knowledge. I believe I am keeping part of the Newton Mass spirit by giving my friends and loved ones gifts of knowledge too, but given Tammy's in the room next to me right now, I've probably said too much. Hope to see both of you in April when Tammy and I get to Australia, Terry. Take care. Bye-bye.
Hey, Tim, we will hook up in Melbourne when you're here. There's no two ways about that. We'll get that sorted out. Yeah, we didn't get DivX here, fortunately. We did get the codec, which helped me download a lot of films somewhat illicitly. Because of economies of scale and infrastructure and things like that, Netflix keep talking about coming into Australia in 2014, but they don't have anything here yet. There are some ways of streaming media from Foxtel, which is our cable provider, but it's a non-trivial task to do that, and it's ridiculously expensive, $5 or $6 a movie. Nobody's going to do that when you can download the movies or the TV shows for nothing. But the Netflix model may turn up here at some stage, but it hasn't yet become a viable option for people around here. You and I are old enough to know what it was like before you could own copies of movies effectively. You could always get great big reels of things if you were rich enough, and a 16mm projector or even an 8mm projector with those really shortened versions of old Universal horror films that were available to people. But it wasn't really a good time, and movie buffs had to either sit up late — this is before VCRs as well — sit up late to watch things when they turned up once every 2 years or so on television, or else
travel vast distances to cinemas to see things. I used to travel 50 kilometres by public transport to go and see Hammer horror films on the other side of Sydney on a weekend, because that's the only way I could see these films. And now all I have to do is lean over, reach out, and I've got on Blu-ray 20 plus Hammer horror films within literally arm's reach. And I don't want to go back to that old concept of movies as a service. I like them being a product. I like the fact that if I buy something, I've got it in a physical sense. And I don't want to go back to that. I think that, yes, it's easier for studios and other people to do it the other way, but I don't know whether the balancing kind of thing for the customer is as good as that, as it should be on that. I think that customers should have a say in things, and I think the physical media should be retained for that reason. Particularly here in Australia, we love having copies of things. Yes, we'll illegally download Game of Thrones, as a lot of people do here, but they also sell shitloads of Blu-rays and DVDs when the box sets come out. So people do get the physical artifacts and do appreciate getting the physical artifacts, and Game of Thrones is doing gangbuster business in places like JB Hi-Fi, which sells DVDs and Blu-rays. Yeah, it's the thing is that the people who really want non-physical media tend to be the people who live in those houses that don't have any clutter to them. And they tend to be overall wealthy. They can get whatever they like, whenever they like. They've got good access to broadband, which is another discussion they're having here in Australia on which kind of a national broadband network we should get, the dodgy one that the Conservatives want us to have, or a reasonable and upgradable one, which was the original plan under the Labor government to get fibre to every to 98% of the houses in Australia, which is a very big country. And basically have an upgradable service there that would enrich the country in numerous ways. But anyway, Tim sent me a second voicemail, because that's the sort of guy he is, and I'll play it for you now.
Hi, Terry. This is Tim from the internet once again, and we're back home in upstate New York following a week in a hotel in New York City where I recorded my last message from. Anyway, a few further thoughts about the streaming movies as a service, not a product. If I covered some of this in my previous message, I apologize. What I was trying to get at was that there has been a school of thought since at least the mid-90s, which basically said in television and media criticism that said that, you know, this content is so precious, it must be protected. Everyone are pirates. They're all going to steal your content. And that's why the movie and television and, well, big media in general is desperately interested in offering streaming as the main option. They want to offer that to all of us, because then you can't steal it, because we're all thieves. This is a Hammer, Leo Laporte of the Twit Network hits a great deal, actually. And not that he doesn't believe in it. He also feels that the big media companies treat everybody like thieves, and as a result, people tend to not disappoint them. Whereas if they basically assume that most people only want to make copies for their own use, maybe trade with a friend here and there, and that, in fact, getting your stuff out for as many people as possible, getting as many eyeballs as possible, is in the long run much better for your media than hanging on to it with a grip of iron. And, well, as big media would love to do, they'd love to charge you every time you watch it. I mean, they already tried that with the DVD format DivX, which I think I mentioned in my last voicemail to you. It was, as somebody said, it was a technology only a lawyer could love. You had to hook it up to a phone line. The phone line called in before you could even watch the movie. You could only watch the movie for a 48-hour period before the you either had to call to permanently or no, unlock the disc for another month or unlock the disc permanently each time, billing your credit card for more money, or it just became unplayable and basically it became landfill. So they thought this was a wonderful idea, and they got Disney on board, and they got Paramount on board, and they got a couple of other studios on board, and it tanked after about a year. Disney, which was the biggest studio proponent of DivX, they went whole hog into it the first year, put about, I'd say, a third of their catalog out on DivX. They ended up having to pull back their horns very hard and release their stuff on DVD in the same pattern they were releasing it on VHS, because they were incredibly embarrassed by how poorly DivX sold. Nobody wanted them. They were too hard to set up. They were an insult to the audience. They charged them pretty much every time they watched the movie. Now, if your kids want to watch Disney movies, as kids tend to do, that meant for a parent, they had to buy the disc. They had to bless the disc for the first 48 hours. Then they had to bless the disc again for, say, another month. Then they had to bless the disc a third time to get to play it just like a plain old DVD would. And if you ever wanted the proof that Disney is basically, in a corporate sense, a bunch of greed heads, DivX and Disney support of it is the strongest evidence in that direction. What I think is going to happen is pretty much what I said to you in an earlier voicemail I left. What I think is going to happen is that as streaming becomes more mainstream for everybody. I mean, right now it's kind of a semi-mainstream thing in the U.S., but there's still a lot of problems. I mean, yes, plenty of people have Netflix streaming, but plenty of people can't. The bar to setting up is still too high. You need basically a wireless router that can stream at least 802.11n. And preferably higher, like AC or AD, which AD isn't out yet, but it is coming. You need a fast enough broadband connection that you can stream high definition, which is at least, I think, 12 megabits a second steady down, not burst mode, but steady down, which a lot of people still don't have. I mean, a lot of people still have got broadband that's like, say, 2 megabits down or 5 megabits down, not 12 or 15. And the thing is that at least in the U.S., the cable companies really don't want to sell it to people. They're only beginning to offer broadband reluctantly. Verizon, which is one of our major telcos here in the United States, laid out fiber optic cable in select areas and offered a service called Fios. Thankfully, where I'm living right now is one of those select areas, so we got Fios for our home and for my office. But the fact is that after they laid it out, and one of the reasons they got a monopoly in a lot of cases, or a duopoly, they were one of the main internet providers for like an entire municipality, was they said, oh, we're going to lay out Fios everywhere. We have a municipality. They started to do that. They did part of where I'm living right now. And they went, you know, this is too expensive. We're just going to quit. And they haven't wired the rest of the city for Fios. So if you live in a neighborhood like we live in, well, you've got fiber optic broadband, which can go up as fast as 100 down if you want to pay the money for it. If you don't live in a neighborhood, you've got DSL, which has maybe 3 megabits a second down and like one up, something like that. I have no idea what your broadband is like in Australia, but I think I've heard you complain about it a few times, so I'm wondering just how effective HD streaming is going to be in a country where, as you said, outside of the major cities, most people don't really have broadband worthy of the name. My thought is that as broadband becomes more popular and more, well, broadband becomes more reliable for everybody, at least in the developed world, you'll start to see a split between most people who are just streaming most of their content because it's easier that way, and it means they can have it right away. And as I mentioned in my last voicemail, you'll have those people who are looking, who want the special features, want the stuff that they don't stream, want the offbeat, want the director's cuts as well as the studio cuts, want the commentary, and will spend more money to buy the higher end Blu-rays and DVDs. I think it will be a real boon for companies like Criterion and Kino here in the U.S. And other elite disc-making companies. I don't know if you have – well, I know you know you have Criterion in Australia, or at least you get Criterion from us for Australia. But there are a handful of companies that turn out high-end discs. They, I think, will continue to prosper because – there's always a market for that, but the people who just buy a disc to buy a disc, those companies are going to go the way of the dodo as streaming becomes more popular. Although right now Netflix is a huge problem in that they don't have every movie ever or even most of the popular movies ever. They keep getting rid of movies, they keep adding movies, and people are always getting really frustrated by the fact that the movie they wanted to stream or the TV show they wanted to stream suddenly isn't there because, well, we lost the license to it for now and it's too expensive to get it again. So I think what we're going to see is the elite companies, the companies that do elite disc sets continue to sell their disc sets. And the companies that take obscure movies like Warner Archive will continue to thrive largely because what they will do is they will offer DVD-R or Blu-ray-R on demand for those of us who want to buy the discs, like, say, Winter Kills, which was, as you rightly said, a DVD-R. I will address that in a future voicemail to you. Anyway, glad to hear you and Sally had a great Newton Mass. Hope you have a great new year. And I'm really looking forward to seeing you guys in Australia in April. So take care, Terry, and have a good day. Bye-bye.
Hey, Tim. Yeah, basically, that's going to be an ongoing argument. We do have a bunch of different companies doing very good material out here. Umbrella Entertainment, if you Google Umbrella Entertainment, have a lot of good stuff. Mad Men Video also have a lot of good stuff. They're the two that are really doing the interesting things. There are the big studio things as well, but Mad Men and Umbrella are doing slightly more niche stuff. Mad Men does a lot of anime and has an immense fan base among teenagers and early 20s in that regard. But they also do cult movies and other things like that, which are of great value to most of us. But, it's an ongoing argument that's going to be had, and it does hinge, as you said, on the availability of a decent internet speed, which we may or may not get depending on how the stupid conservative government goes. It's very much up in the air. Media delivery companies, if they've got any sense, should be lobbying government to get the proper broadband network set up. But whether that happens or not, it's still very much up in the air. These guys are shooting themselves in the foot on a daily basis. They really weren't prepared for government when they came in, and they're fucking up a lot of things. And I could rant about the ongoing cruelty of Australia's asylum seeker policy, but that's getting enough play on a whole bunch of other media, including Facebook. But anyway, I'm going to wrap it up there. I think I don't have any more feedback. If I do, I'll just take a quick look. I did get a brief message on the Martian Drive-In podcast website, marsdrivein.blogspot.com, from a guy called Buffalo Davids, who says, the Merry Marvel Marching Society. He still remembers his ID number from the Merry Marvel Marching Society, talking back to the last podcast where we did the Marvel Cinematic Universe. His number was 13429. Yep, we didn't get that here, which is unfortunate, because I would have joined the Merry Marvel Marching Society had I the opportunity to do so, but it wasn't availed of me, which is kind of shitty, but there you go. I'm making up for it now by buying all the Blu-rays as they come out. I'm looking forward to the two Marvel films coming out in 2014, being Captain America the Winter Soldier, and most of all Guardians of the Galaxy, which we may do a podcast about. I might do a Martian Drive-In podcast. I might get Rob Jam back and we'll geek out over Guardians of the Galaxy perhaps, but I'll see what Rob's availability is like at that stage, and we'll go to it from there. But anyway, that's about it this time around. Enjoy your movie watching over the next couple of weeks. I've got a shitload of Blu-rays to watch from my Newton Mass Hall, and I hope everybody scored well in that regard over the festive season. I'll be back in 2 weeks with another Martian Drive-In podcast, and next week with another Paleo Cinema podcast. I don't know what the fuck I'm going to be doing there, but it will be something. But anyway, look after yourselves. Stay warm if you're in the north. Stay cool if you're in the south. And I'll be back. Bye.